Hello everyone and welcome to Femme on Film. It is me, your host Rhea. I'm back again, obviously, it's my show. Starting well, I am here to talk about women and film, feminism, all the usual things that we talk about on Femme on Film, but this is a slightly different one. We are not taking a film or an idea of a film and sort of discussing it and how it makes us feel and where it fits in feminism awesomeness. I am here to talk to an amazing guest, which my Femme on co-host Alison introduced me to, us to, and made this happen. And we've just been talking about how stressful I find names. So here we go. Our amazing guest, who I'm very excited to talk to, is Elissa Bassist. I did it wrong, didn't I?
A little wrong.
Do you know what?
You put a French twist on it.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what's hilarious? I'm awful at French, so let's just pretend that I'm just making you seem a bit French.
I think you can also blame the accent. I find
that. Oh yeah, okay.
Yeah. Elissa Bassist.
Bassist. See, there we go.
So how this came about was I read Elissa's book last year when it came out, Hysterical. It's a memoir that is hysterical, but it also deconstructs kind of these ideas that women who have feelings are hysterical, which is something that is one of my favorite things to think and deconstruct. So the book was really hit my sweet spot. And I was talking to everyone about it, including all the Femme on co-hosts. And I'm friends with Elissa on Facebook, even though we've never met. And recently she posted a newsletter talking about how she believes that a film shouldn't be Oscar eligible unless it passes the Bechdel test. And I agree.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like such a revolutionary point of view that it is both infuriating and comical. And it did also lead me to think about films that matter to me and even like my favorite films from the past year. And they all do pass the test. So that was just a fun thing for my brain to just sort of play with, like, oh, well, what were my favorite films from last year? Barbie, Past Lives, mm-hmm. You Hurt My Feelings. You know, these films very easily pass the test. And so here we are. Elissa said yes, and I'm just thrilled to be in conversation with the two of you.
Thank you so much for having me on this podcast. Longtime listener, first time guest. And I love that you love that newsletter because I posted it on Facebook with the heading, I had only lost subscribers from the newsletter. And I had, when I first posted it, I lost so many subscribers. And I was like, I can't believe, like, I thought, like, in my mind, I was like, this is viral. This is, like, everyone's going to love this idea. And people didn't because we get to be reminded a million times a day how sexist and misogynist everyone still is and loves to be. So,
well, and I think it's interesting too because you would assume that subscribers to your newsletter are feminist. Like, I think that that's a really safe assumption, or I would believe that's a safe assumption to make. And you're just making a really pretty basic feminist argument, you know. So it's like, oh, this is offensive, and that's the fun of feminism or any sort of like standing up for anyone, you know. You're like, oh no, it's only cool in this way, you know. It's only cool to be feminist when it's like this, or, you know, anti-capitalist or whatever it is that you want to talk about. And
right, like, feminism tear is down cool for reproductive rights, but feminism is less cool when you come for our entertainment.
It was amazing. So Alison sent me your Substack, and so I read it. And before talking to you, obviously, I read Hysterical, which was just, like, I loved it. I completely understand why Alison kept on saying you have to read it. And I was like, oh no, why did it take me so long? And I loved reading the two together because I could tell that I've been on a real journey. We sort of discussed this briefly, like, you know, I've been watching films from a really young age. One of the first jobs I ever said I wanted to be was a film director, and then everybody told me I wouldn't be able to because I'm a girl. So then I decided to not have that dream. And, you know, I've had a real reckoning over the last few years of what is the content I want to watch? How do I want to spend my time? I don't have a lot of free time. I talk about this all the time. I have a child who doesn't sleep, so I don't sleep. So, you know, my time is really limited, and I don't want to spend it watching Killers of the Flower Moon, for example, as we've already discussed. I do not give a shit. I do not want Martin Scorsese telling this story. I'm not interested. And then I loved, like, I was reading your book and then reading the article that you've written, and I was just like, oh my God, I feel so seen. But also I loved that you've also had that bit of a reckoning about, what the fuck am I doing spending my time watching this man bullshit?
Right. And so, Allison, you were saying that your favorite films pass the Bechdel test. So mine don't.
Yeah.
And I am my own worst enemy, where I'm like, I love the stuff that hates me and that hates women. Mm-hmm. And some of my favorites of all time and the past year and yesterday don't pass the Bechdel test. So I have to work like extra hard to remind myself that I don't like what I like. Like, the culture has told me that I like this, or I'm just bombarded by it and there's nothing else on and I want to be distracted. And I also have become like numb to it, while also having taken the feminist red pill, where I notice that everything I watch has to have boobs or a murdered woman or a violated woman, a harassed woman, a silenced woman. Like, she's always there. Like, I can't escape it. Mm-hmm. Even in Barbie, which was like made for me, made for us, I still, I liked what I liked, but I saw so many problems, so many like patriarchal problems. And we don't need to get into it, because it's like, that's not the point I want to make about that movie. So it's just so hard to enjoy anything.
I think I felt a lot that way right after I got out of film school. And I want to say, I think part of the reason that you like those films, I would guess, I mean, they are canonical. And I think that's something that we ingest. We're told these are great films, particularly if you're coming up in any kind of academic system, you're like, oh, well, I have to see The Godfather. You know, like, this is important. Apocalypse Now, Goodfellas, you know, these films are great films. And so I was really motivated to find films that spoke to me in that academic environment. That I agree, these are great. Okay, fine. Sure. But then I was motivated to find movies that spoke to me. And I was thinking about like my favorite films from that time, because I was very like kind of emo artsy person. And so it was like Bergman and Kieslowski, and they were about women. I couldn't find that many movies by women that I could have the debate with people about that they were great, but I could at least find films that had women in them and that were discussing their inner lives with some seriousness, which to me felt like a win. And that was the best I could do, which is tragic.
I often feel the best I can do is a man writing about a woman.
Yeah.
And giving her a joke or two.
Yeah.
But yeah, she still has like cleavage up the wazoo.
Yep. She has to be, I mean, and I've told this story like many times, but in film school, I exclusively make art about women. And so I would make all my films about women. And in my film school class, it was 50 and it was like 8 women and 42 men. And I literally had a guy say to me, well, I don't like any of your stuff, but at least you cast hot women so I can watch it. And I felt like that was such a, like, he was just saying what everyone else was thinking. And I certainly internalized that, and also felt like to some degree I needed to be pleasing in order to keep making things. Like, I definitely needed to play a certain amount of a game to even be taken seriously, which is so retrograde.
I think about that so much with my book. Like, it's funny. And it's funny because it's dark and I feel that people will listen to a joke over a sob story, and I respond so well to humor, and my favorite art is the art that like disarms you with comedy and then punches you in the heart with tragedy. Mm-hmm. But I think also at the same time, I was trying to please a male audience and make them laugh. So I was like, I'm being funny. Mm-hmm. So I'm not being like sad and emotional. So I can appeal to you. Like it still came out of like a pleasing sensibility where I was like, I'm showing off for you so that
And
you could enjoy this because you like jokes. You don't like emotion, but you like jokes.
And also, I'm not another one of those women who wants you to like listen to their problems and take them seriously. I'm not a navel gazing, self-involved bitch. You know, I think we've always internalizing that, right? Like we need to make it palatable to them in some way. Sexy. I mean, even though I write about women, I still think about that. But then at some level, I've accepted that men aren't my audience, which doesn't make it very commercial.
That's the thing. And I'm working on a comedy writing craft book right now. And in the introduction and in the proposal, we're writing about how like men joke and men like men's jokes and women like men's jokes. But if women joke, only women like women's jokes. So you're alienating half the universal audience. But I think we have to like get to a point where like women don't like men's jokes, like as a whole, like we feel like we have to, so we have to laugh. And we do have to better pick our audiences and know that like there's room for tampon jokes. And like, we really have to change the definition of comedy and change the definition of what's funny and learn to appeal to our audience as opposed to cater to our non-audience.
Agree.
And we just totally have to like rewire our brain.
Yes.
And society.
But I think that it starts with us. And I 1,000,000% agree to you because I realized that I was spending so much time and energy trying to appeal to people who were never going to like my work.
Yeah.
Like, why am I doing this? Why am I not making the work that I know is good better instead of trying to make myself into someone I'm not?
That was my entire career, and trying to sell a book and trying to have jobs. I was always trying to be someone I wasn't so that I could succeed and just be a watered down small version of me.
Well, and they guarantee you that that's where success lay. I mean, like that's also what happens like within the construct of an MFA, or if you're doing some kind of, you're trying to get agented or you're going through these processes, it is definitely like, if you give us X, we will give you success. And then if you do all the things, which I did, and I was literally just talking about this with a friend yesterday, I did everything they told me to do and it didn't make me rich. And then you're left with a fucking husk of yourself. And it's devastating because you gave it all away for free. You know, like that's, I'm a bad woman and a bad capitalist. And it's just, so now it's like, I have to just stay true to myself, whatever that means. And I know that that's privilege to be able to do that. But I also feel like that's what I should be doing with my privilege.
Yeah. I mean, yes. Well, we learned that it was a con. So we have to tell everyone else through example that it's a con.
Yeah.
So take that privilege so that you can show other people that it can be different.
Yeah. Well put. So do you like some films? Yes. Write that down. Because I do think that we silence ourselves thinking, well, I shouldn't, like, I definitely silence myself thinking, oh, this is privilege. Like, it is important to be reminded that speaking up with your privilege is like what it's all for.
Yeah, as opposed to like doing the woman thing, which is constantly apologizing, hedging, and like giving disclaimers. And you would also rather not say anything in case you were going to offend.
Yeah, in case you're going to lose subscribers.
Yeah.
There's a real life metric. I had a friend who was losing followers on Instagram because she was posting some personal content people didn't like. And so she told me she was going to stop posting them. And I was like, well, fuck them. And then she was like, oh, you're right. I wasn't trying to be right. But, you know, she was like, oh, yeah, I should just post whatever I want to post. Like, it's something we're all pushing up against all the time. Like with our work, with our relationships, with social media, like trying to please people.
Yes. And it's all too easy in this economy to take people who unsubscribe as feedback, as like valid feedback that helps us shape our future projects. And I remember it starting for me on Twitter where it's like, if I had a bad tweet, then I would delete it.
Yeah.
And then it became bigger where it was like, if I have a bad book, I won't write it. Like a bad book according to one person. And I think it's really affecting like all art, where we're so afraid to lose audience that will base our work on that fear. And I hate that.
And that's the exact problem with like female directors, female writers, because they make a film that doesn't do very well. And we see it's something I talk about all the time. Suddenly they're not making a film for 10 years, or they're having to fight to get back into the room, right? Colin Trevorrow makes a subpar Jurassic Park film. I mean, how you fuck up dinosaurs is beyond me. And they give him like three more films. And you're like, this guy. And again, you know, I do like to give you, you know, well done, mediocre white guy, for continuing to succeed. Wonderful for you. Like, great. But it's like, that's what frustrates me so much, you know, that we, and it's like, so then we get this one thing. They go, oh, it's all right. You don't need anything else. Oh, she doesn't need to direct anything. She's done her one Marvel film. And people were sort of all right about it. But give like a mediocre white man a Marvel film and he gets five more. And it's just, and it just limits what we get to view as the audience constantly. And it makes me so angry, which is, you know, and it feeds into everything. It feeds into that belief that, well, only white men can make films that everybody enjoys. Oh, you, and you know, like I said, you get that one film and it leaks into everything. So it's what every, you know, so it's what everybody believes. And I have a 5-year-old, a girl. I try so hard to sort of curate that, those conversations that we're having around it, and making her the most woke little feminist as possible. you know, but although she is white, so the worst type of feminist.
We still have to do it though, even though the worst, like the alternative is worse.
Yeah, absolutely.
I just
true,
want to say that out
absolutely.
Loud.
Like, no, absolutely true.
Like, we are very problematic, but the other side wants to make an archaic Arizona law stand for abortion. So devilish.
That's such a good description. I enjoy that.
the white feminist is at least not worse than the white non-feminist.
I mean, obviously there are some exceptions because some of them are just unhinged, but I think for the most part, you know, we should try to endeavor to speak out.
And we do. Yeah. And I think that's good. I felt myself going on a rant. I was about to start talking about My Little Pony. So I don't know where my point was going. But if you want this is where it was going. If you want a feminist cartoon for your children, boys and girls, boys can like ponies and unicorns. My Little Pony, Friendship is Magic. It's the main six. Love it. They go on all these adventures over like 8-9 series. And the only instance I can think of once that the six female characters talk about men or boys is on, they go to a party and one of them wants to meet a prince. And then she realizes princes are stupid and she wants to go back and carry on her like retail emporium. So that's where my rant was going. I can't remember what was in the middle, but that's where I got to the end.
Is it possible that what was in the middle was, even then we get a film like Barbie? Because this is certainly my in the middle. Is we get a film like Barbie and then they get it all wrong. Why it's popular.
Yes.
So we give Greta Gerwig, which she deserves, you know, a 3-picture, 5-picture deal at Amazon, whatever it was. Great. And then it's like, let's revive a bunch of old IP and have Lena Dunham direct Polly Pockets or whatever. You know, it's like, no, that's not why this film is successful. This film is successful because it speaks to us at all different levels of where we are, and it's engaging and entertaining. It's not Barbie. Like that, that was the vehicle, but that was not the reason. And so we went out and voted with our dollars, and then they still got the wrong results. And that is so frustrating.
I know. Why can't we have another Frances Ha? Frances Ha.
She's not interested in making Frances Ha. So that's part of the reason. She's been very vocal about that. I was talking about Lady Bird with on a different podcast, saying, you know, that I do miss the films that she never made, and will continue to miss the films she never made when she's making Narnia. But, you know, she's got to do her.
I have a lot of follow-up questions, but I think that's maybe too much of a tangent because I want to agree about this, the straight white guys failing upward, the mediocre straight white guys failing upward. And like, I see it not only in film, which is for me, in a way easier to ignore as a writer, because at least I have the solace of books, but no, it's happening in books too. Like seeing these guys who are so bad do so well and get so many opportunities and get so and be recognized not only on Goodreads but by the New York Times and by the people who have money and by the consumer. And it's just like, what is this collective delusion, or am I the deluded one? Like, is there no such metric of good art? Like, and then I get very sad and confused, and I'm just like, what is happening with culture? Like, what can we do as consumers, and what can we do as creators? And I don't know what to do anymore.
I think you just have to keep doing your thing, whatever that is. I mean, I think that's really it for us, because it can become so overwhelming that it just paralyzes you. And I think that is how capitalism and patriarchy and white supremacy is designed to work. Mm-hmm. And it's working really well right now. And so we just kind of hope is revolutionary. And we just kind of keep one step at a time, like finding content that speaks to us, supporting that content, creating community around that content and in our lives in general. Like, I think that if we push back against isolating and sitting with our shit and we share it with each other and we write about it and we make films about it, and I think it matters. I have to think it matters, because otherwise I wouldn't get out of bed in the morning. And it's changed my life. And that's like kind of what I keep remembering. Like, maybe everything I make only touches the person I made it with, but that's worth it. That's actually
that's
worth
enough
it.
Too.
Yeah. And that is also revolutionary and anti-capitalist, to say like, this was worth it. Making this thing was worth it. Even if it doesn't make, and I wish it would make everyone millions of dollars, that'd be great. But at the same time, it's not, but that doesn't mean it's worthless. And I'm reminded of that a lot. Every time I have someone share a Where I'm From poem with me on Instagram Live, I would say 9 out of 10 times they say what a meaningful experience it was to them. And it is meaningful to me. So that's two people. And I've done 136. You know, it's slow. It's slow. It would be nice if it was like a mushroom and like it like grew so much and it affected so many lives. But the small numbers matter too.
Right. I think like throughout time, the small numbers have mattered and good art has been ignored. So it isn't like this recent phenomenon that should convince us to do nothing. And like I just wish I could be on a podcast like this every single day and talk to people like you every single day. Like, this to me is the antidote.
Don't say that, because now you're
That's why we do it. I mean, that's honestly why we do it. It's like, you can't get all wrapped up in numbers. It's like, this has changed my life. And like I said to you in the email I sent, like, I just kind of realized in the past 2 years that I just gave things up. Like, when people push too hard at me, I was just like, okay, well, I'm just going to give up poetry. I'm going to give up film. I don't need it. And then what was I left with creatively? And this is reclaiming this for like Rhea inviting me on Femme on Film, us talking about The Kids Are All Right, which is another film that very easily passes the Bechdel test that I love. It was meaningful to me. It was like, I deserve to share what I think about film. Like, I'm a freaking expert. Why did I just like let it go? Because people just told me I was full of shit because I was a feminist. Like, really? Is that was it? And I was just like, okay, I don't have any fight left in me. You can have it.
I mean, it's so depressing that it takes so little to knock us out.
Yeah.
And that like the tools to knock us out are been so well made.
Yeah.
And refined.
Yeah, and honed. Yes.
Yeah. Over the years. And like, when I remember that, I'm like, I won't go down without a fight. Like, I will do anything just to show them that they do not own me.
Yeah. And you're doing that with your classes and your book. Like, your book spoke to me and it spoke to many people. And I know it took a long time for it to get out there and for you to write it. And you share that always. Like, don't worry, it took me 12 years. And I know I'm not the only one who carries it with me, that there's no deadline for self-expression, because there is so much of that. Like, we hear, oh, you know, the 40 hottest people under 40, that, you know, all of those kinds of lists. That we're led to believe, like, well, once you reach a certain age, like, just go off into the fields, although you can't really afford it, so you need to work at Walmart. But, like, the sort of metaphor. And no, I have just as much to say as I did when I was younger. I have actually quite a bit more to say. and I think I say it better than I did when I was 25. When I was 25, I was just fucking pissed.
Yeah.
You know? And I didn't really have context. I didn't really know why I was so angry. I had an inclination, but my arguments are much more cohesive and thoughtful now than they were then.
Yeah, I love now that I get to be pissed and insightful.
Yeah. Yeah.
It pissed works though, because pissed with hindsight. I love that. Because I think what you post on Substack about the Oscars and films and the Bechdel test, I think if you Google Bechdel test, like, there's so many videos and stuff to watch and people using examples of it and stuff like that. But, you know, when you're talking to somebody, whether it, you know, whoever they are, and you talk about this, it feels like you can get really, like, stuck in the weeds of, like, this is the Bechdel test, feminist, all this sort of stuff. Your article, like, what you've done is so clever, when you've literally gone, this counts, I've got it up in front of me, Emma, yeah. I'm sorry, Emily, no, I'm sorry, Emma, don't be sorry, I'm the one who is sorry, Emily, oh, I'm sorry, you're right, I'm sorry, and then Emma, please, the apology is all mine. Not only hilarious because women saying sorry, but also it's the perfect example of, that's all that's needed.
Yeah.
Female characters.
The bar is so low.
So low. And I'm like, I want to screen grab this and, like, every week, just put it on Instagram. If you don't understand the Bechdel test, this is a version of passing it. Because it's like, you know, I also think, like, people, especially women, can feel intimidated when it comes to discussions about film, because it is so male dominated, because we're so used to hearing what men have to say about it. When you Google Bechdel test, there are articles written by men explaining the Bechdel test. Love it. Of course there are. And I'm like, but what you've done is you've made it accessible for people to understand why it's important to have women in film, not just being a love interest, not just with their boobs out, and just saying sorry to each other.
Yes, interacting with each other. Women have relationships with each other that don't revolve around their sex lives. I know it's hard to believe this is true, but it is. And it's so interesting how I feel like one of our superpowers as women is community building, and it's completely marginalized within fictional properties. And I don't think that's a coincidence, because I think they're afraid of us.
Oh, for sure. I mean, yeah. Everything anyone does is because they're afraid of us. I mean, everything that's happening with abortion is because they're afraid of us. I mean, everything.
For sure.
And it's like, I wish we all knew that and could use that. And I was just watching a TikTok with Rose McGowan, who is very, very well spoken. And the interviewer was asking her, like, aren't you afraid of going up against all these powerful people? And she lists, like, all these powerful people. And Rose McGowan says, I'm not afraid because I'm powerful too. And I was like, whoa.
Mm-hmm. And she's telling the truth.
Yeah. But they've convinced us that we're not.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, which all ties back to your book, Hysterical, which is, you know, something I carry with me and I write about and care about, because, you know, my maternal grandmother died in a mental institution because she was problematic and her family didn't want her around anymore. And I think so many women carry that in our DNA. Like, if we become problematic, we will be eliminated. And I think it's been interesting to me when I share that story with people, a shocking amount of people have the same story. And we get to be problematic. We're actually just being ourselves.
No, it's not problematic. It's just the wrong definition.
Yeah.
I mean, they've just, I mean, and I write about this in Hysterical, how men literally wrote the dictionary. They literally wrote the thesaurus, a word I can never pronounce.
You're
And
making
they did
three
that
up
on purpose.
it.
They literally formed our language and our definition of everything. So of course the definitions are wrong. Like, and I write about how like the clitoris is misdefined in the dictionary still to this day. So it's like we need to challenge all of these words like crazy, because the definitions have been written to suit those who use them against us.
Yes, they're weapons. They've been weaponized to silence us. I
Yeah.
mean, they're doing it in the courts, but they're also doing it in our language and in the canon. And I think it's important to talk about that because those things really affect us when we are introduced to literature at a young age and film and television, and we don't see ourselves reflected. It sends us a message that we're not worth seeing.
Yes, it's all connected. And I was looking at my notes for the newsletter and I forgot to add, or maybe I got a little bit in there, but it's all connected. Like films failing the Bechdel test that win Academy Awards, it's connected to abortion. Like, and I realized this, and I was lucky that the book took me so long to get it sold and published because I needed to make all the connections, which was the sexism I experienced at school and in relationships and at work and in doctor's offices. It was all the same sexism playing out in different arenas. And it only clicked to me when it was happening in the doctor's offices, which was like a late ad in the book, which became the book. But then I was like, the TV I watch, the men I have sex with, the doctors I go to save my life, like they're all in on it and I'm in on it. And when we are still giving 13 award nominations to a film where women are hardly featured, like in the same year that we're rolling back reproductive rights, like it's not a coincidence. Like this is they've been planning for this, they wanted this. This is their wet dream. It's happening.
Well, and the great men narrative is a very powerful one.
Yeah.
And that plays into that. And I think just that whole patriarchal message of like, we know best. And so those kinds of things really appeal to people in power who have the ability to green light because they're usually men. And that speaks to who they are, right? It's like, oh, yeah, we all understand how this works and we're going to provide you what you need. So, oh.
While
We have
you're
not
both,
solved the world's
we
problems.
have
We have
not.
discussed them. And I think that that is
Just one
important.
last thing. Whilst you're both talking, I was thinking about the strong female character, and I did a quick Google. I was listening, I promise. I can multitask. I know that's not real. And I was thinking about the strong female character, and I was like, because I sent you both a meme about the manic pixie dream girl as well, and I was like, how was the strong female character created? So I thought. It's very loose research that I just did in like the last 2 minutes. And basically, I've realized that even the strong female character was created by men. You know, the first one that comes up is Wikipedia, to be fair, is Buffy Summers, right? I'm a huge Buffy fan, sadly, due to the person who created it, created by a man who is an asshole. You know, and it's kind of like even that character and that character's been absolutely bastardized. You know, when it, and I can't stand the idea of the strong female character anymore because it's what a man envisions a strong woman is, and it's like being physically strong. It's not a woman who is multi-dimensional and can do like lots of different things, and feminine traits aren't allowed in a strong female character. You know, you think about strong female characters, you think about Ripley in Alien, written as a male character, and obviously Sigourney, you know, and then it's Sigourney Weaver, and it's sort of like, so even our like precious female characters in film are and TV are created by men. It's not until we start getting films directed by women, written by women, that we get characters that are the character I was talking about recently was completely forgotten. How could I forget Amazing Amy's name in Gone Girl, right? And you know, and men's minds were blown. They were like, oh my God, a psychopathic woman. And I was like, And like, and the fact that that's new to male audiences, is bonkers. Again, I'm just on a thought train. I'm so sorry. And no, I'm not apologising. Take that apology back. You know, and then I was thinking back, like when we look at Femme Fatales, and they are bad, but actually, aren't they actually the first original strong female characters? Like, just because they're not doing what a man wants, it doesn't mean they're bad.
Yeah, you wait till you get to chapter 8 in my book called Must See Dead Girl TV, because I talk all about female character and how they're all created by men. And my beloved Buffy, I just quoted Angel earlier, where it was like, to show them they don't own us, is from season 5 of Angel. And I worship that show, that spinoff show, like that world. And it's devastating that it was created not only by a man, but a bad man. And I have to find a way to still be able to love that while hating it and while looking for something better and looking to redefine strong female character. And knowing that, like, I could love it in my youth, and now as an adult, I'm going to go find, like, the quiet journalist. She's the strong female character now.
Yeah, you won't be surprised to know that was one of my favorite chapters in your book. But I'm also a lover of horror. I love horror, and you know, and I know horror's very problematic. I think the new batch of horror that's coming out is addressing some of those problematic things, although lots of them directed by men, although I feel like feminist men. And so, you know, when I was reading that, and I loved reading your book and thinking about why, you know, I've talked to Alison about this, who doesn't like horror, about why I like horror and why I like Final Girls and stuff like that. And I felt like your book gave me an opportunity to rethink those things and why I like it. And I found it challenging in a good way. And, you know, that it's been the same thing with Buffy. As a big Buffy fan, I'll show you my Buffy doll in a minute.
I love horror. I love horror so much. I mean, there aren't any simple solutions besides more women must make more things, and we must give them all the money.
Yeah, and I think also just when you interrogate things that you watch, instead of just taking them at face value, because of course we're showing our kids things that we watched, and some of them age very poorly.
Yep.
And some of them are surprisingly okay. And it's not necessarily what you might expect. But there is a certain like shock to the system when you show them something that's beloved to you and you're like, oh, this is terrible, which does happen. And I wanted to say something about Femme Fatales, because I was so struck by it when Karina Longworth talked about it. You must remember this, that how they were set up, they had to die because they were sexual and they were evil because of their sexuality. And I think that, you know, obviously she would make the case and does throughout her podcast that that is what we do with women in film. We punish them for their sexuality. And I highly recommend that podcast to anyone who's interested in looking at cinema through a feminist lens, because it has been so validating for me, because she puts words to these things that I carry with me, but she's done the research. So that was my parting when you brought up Femme Fatales, because I thought she explores it so well in the podcast.
You mean she doesn't just do a quick Google whilst talking to two people? She actually does her job properly.
You did a very good job.
A quick Google can reveal so much, though, because it's like, what's at the top of the internet? Like, I think that is, it reveals so much. Some of my research in the book was a quick Google, because I just wanted to get, like, what's like the quick glance where if you Googled something, what do you see first? Because that's what most people are doing. Like, very few people are doing a deep dive and like checking their sources and fact checking it all. So I think your research method was valid.
Yes. And the reality is that Wikipedia is what people use oftentimes instead of the prime, you know, the original source. We just take Wikipedia. So you're doing it right.
And then Wikipedia, I think, is like 90% of the editors are men.
Yes, something absolutely mad like that. I actually listened to somebody say something like that on a podcast, I think last week, about how the information we get is edited by men. I can't remember what it is. I'll have to dig it out. I'll put it in the show notes or send it to you.
Yeah, I like dealt with so many stats in the book where it was like most of our news is reported by men. Most news on reproductive rights and on violence against women is reported by men. Like, and throwing down those numbers because we see the numbers. I mean, if you're inside feminist baseball, you see the numbers for film and TV and how those ratios are so off. But like those ratios reflect everything else.
Yep. And it's important to remind ourselves of that. And it may be not even the most reliable, legitimate male website journalists.
Yeah.
Let me just throw that out there.
I mean, how could it be? How can anything be reliable when it's one point of view repeated over and over and over again? No matter what it is, whether it's the news or a story or a novel, fiction, like when it's the same point of view, like that's inherently not reliable. You need multiple sources.
Yep. Well, is it time to wrap up, Rhea?
It is. I there's like three other things I was going to say, but I'm not going to because our time is limited. No, no. They're just random tangents. I'll talk to you both afterwards. Thank you so much, Alyssa. I am finding it hard to wrap up because there are lots of other things that I want to talk about. But please tell everybody where they can find you and also obviously make them buy your book.
Yes, please find me on the internet at alyssabassist.com. That's ElisaBassist.com. That's also my handle on all the social medias. I live in Brooklyn if you're interested in dating me. Just always got to That's how we date now. That's since we don't have dating apps, we just have to put that out there on every podcast we're on. Yeah, my website has classes if you want to learn how to write funny and write dark and book information and headshot information.
Thank
I also
so
have
much.
A newsletter called Tragedy
Plus. Oh, yes, you definitely do.
I have two newsletters on Substack.
Yeah.
I have to remember to promote my other promotable thing. Tragedy Plus Time on Substack for writers and creatives, and Hysterical on Substack for crazy psycho bitches.
Yes. Part of that gang.
Yeah, proud to be a part of that. Both of those groups.
I'm just the crazy psycho bitch group. That's fine with me. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love this chat. I am wrapping up. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening. I was about to say something else then. There's like a million podcasts. There's too many by men, too many about murdered women. So listen to us instead. We're awesome. Subscribe, rate, review, all of that sort of stuff. Every listen is wonderful. It makes me feel happy and makes my heart feel great. So thank you very much.
Smash the paint, Jamarski.